Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to 3 Ideas in 30 Minutes, our opportunity to get ready for Shabbos, to prepare ourselves with some Divrei Torah, some conversations, point of departure for conversations, hopefully, for our Shabbos table. And it's so wonderful to see so many of you again here this morning. It's a real zchus to be able to learn together every single Friday morning. I want to dedicate our shir today, or our shir is dedicated today, anonymously in memory of Teddy Kellen, Shimon Tuvia, Ben Dov, Yehuda Leib Chaim, Zichrono Levracha. Our learning should be an aliyah for his neshama. For those of you who have been participating every week, you know that we've been learning regularly in memory of Teddy Kellen. We're grateful for the sponsor who has enabled that. And actually, Teddy's yurtzeit, his first yurtzeit, is this coming Sunday, the 10th day of Tammuz. And so I want to spend just a moment reflecting upon a little bit who Teddy was. Teddy, of course, was our neighbor in Thornhill Mews. He was an amazingly humble person, an enormously generous person, someone whose focus and really his priority in life was his family. He's a beautiful family, a very dedicated family, and it's a real loss for us and for our community. And so again, our learning should be, and it continued, should be for an aliyah for his neshama as it approaches his first yahrzeit. If anyone's interested in sponsoring a future class of 3 Ideas in 30 Minutes, please do not hesitate to be in touch with me or with Lee in the shul office. And again, it's a great opportunity for a yahrzeit, for a birthday, for an anniversary, or just to express gratitude to someone in your life. Okay, 3 Ideas in 30 Minutes. As you know, I struggle. When to do my favorite idea? Do I do it at the beginning? Do I do it at the end? Do I do it in the middle? I don't want you to drop off after the first idea and say, ah, I got the best one. Now I don't have to be here anymore. But I'm going to do the first one, which is a new idea that I saw this year. And I think it's a beautiful idea. It definitely helped me view a certain set of psukim in a different context. And hopefully, as you'll see, a greater appreciation for Hashem and our emunah in Hashem, which of course we're always trying to improve upon. The pasuk in this week's parsha tells us, Ki Cheshbon, Ir Sichon, Melech Amorihi, that Cheshbon was the city of Sichon, Vihinil Cham B'Melech Moav Harishon, he fought against the former king of Moav, Vayikach Eskol Arzo Miado Ad Arnon. In Cheshbon, or Sichon, was able to destroy Moav, he was able to conquer Moav, and take all of his land as far as Arnon. Now we say, in the 27th pasuk of that parak, parak Chavalef, Al Kain, therefore, because of the battle of Sichon over Moab, Yomru Hamoshlim Bo Cheshbon Tibane V'Tikonen Ir Sichon, come to Cheshbon, firmly built and well-founded in Sichon's city. So again, you have this battle between Sichon and Moab. Sichon is victorious over Moab, and so we sing this song, Al Kain, therefore, because of the battle, Yomru Hamoshlim Bo'u Cheshbon, come to Cheshbon, the beautiful, firmly entrenched city of Sichon. What's interesting is the Gemara in Baba Basra. The Gemara in Baba Basra on Daf 78b tells us the following. Hamoshlim, who are these Al Kain Yomru Hamoshlim that the Moshlim should say? So the Gemara says, Hamoshlim, Elu Hamoshlim B'Yitzram. Moshel means to conquer. These are the ones who are able to conquer, to rule over their evil inclination. Bo'u Cheshbon. They should come to Cheshbon. What does that mean, says the Gemara? Bo'u unechashev Cheshbonu shel olam hefsed mitzvah keneged schara uschar avera keneged hefseda. They should do a Cheshbon anefesh. They should do a calculation, an accounting of their soul. Right? What is the financial loss incurred by the fulfillment of a mitzvah versus the reward that you get? And conversely, what is the reward you get by an aveira opposite the punishment you're going to get? In other words, have a little bit of a cheshbon and nefesh, do a calculation, is it really worth it? What's interesting to note, and Rav Nevinsal points this out a few years ago in one of his Parsha classes, Rav Nevinsal points out that that is a beautiful understanding of Cheshbon and Moshlim, that those who are Moshel on their Yitzhara, those who are able to rule and conquer the Yitzhara, Bo Cheshbon, they should do a Cheshbon on Nefesh. And what is the Cheshbon on Nefesh? What is the calculation, the evaluation, the introspection that they're supposed to do? They're supposed to reflect upon the loss that you get from a mitzvah versus the reward, right? So if I give a dollar to tzedakah, I lose a dollar, but my reward is much greater. Keneged, opposite, the reward I get for doing Avera, that cheesy, that delicious cheeseburger, might be delicious now, but Keneged Hefseda, is it really worth it in the grand scheme of things? So what the Gemara is really encouraging us to do is to look beyond the here and now and to contemplate the totality of our religious experience. Where Rav Nevensaal does not understand is what in the world does that have to do with the previous pasuk? Again, the previous pasuk tells us about a war between Sichon and Moab. Sichon is victorious, and therefore, Al Kain, because Sichon is victorious, therefore, those who are conquering their Yitzhara, they should do a Cheshbon HaNefesh. What does one have to do with another? Al Kain implies that there's a direct correlation between the first pasuk and the second pasuk. In our case, it's, again, Perek Chaf Aleph, pasuk Chavav and Chav Zayin. What's the connection between the two of them in the eyes of the Gemara? So Rav Nevensaal, I thought, had a truly magnificent interpretation. He says, if you were following the news at the time of Parshas Chukas, right, if the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times were reporting at the time of Chukas, what would the report, what would the headline look like after Pasuk 26? I happen to have in my office, for those who have been here, the front page in the New York Times on the day that Israel was founded. It was from my grandparents' house when they cleaned out my grandparents' house. So let's just say some of my older cousins were more aggressive in what they got to take from my grandparents, and little old Phil got left with not so much. But this was one of the things that was left over, and I thought it was very sentimental. So I took it, and it's hanging in my office. The front page of the New York Times, founding the State of Israel. I'm looking at it right now. Zionists proclaim new State of Israel. Truman recognizes it in hopes for peace. Tel Aviv is bombed. Egypt orders invasion. In of itself, that's a bizarre headline, but that's for another time. So what would the headlines have been? Sichon defeats Moab. What would you think the headline would be? So the headline would something be along the lines of, right, Sichon, great military prowess, defeats his archenemy. The defeat is bound to alter the face of the Middle East, right? That's the type of language you would have expected after Pasuk 26. It was a magnificent victory that Sichon was able to conquer Moab. These are not small countries. These are mighty military powers. And so when Sichon conquers Moab, there's a dramatic shift in the entire Middle East. The headlines would have been big and bold about the changing demographics of the Middle East. What do we know, of course? Right? What ultimately happened? So again, I'm going to speak about it a little bit on Shabbos morning in BRS, but at the end of the Parsha, the Jewish people wage war against Sichon, and they're able to destroy and conquer Sichon. And therefore, as a result of Sichon, as a result of them beating Sichon, they don't just conquer what Sichon has, but they also conquer what Sichon had conquered from Moab. See what's happening here? Sichon is able to conquer Moab. Therefore, when we conquer Sichon, we're able to conquer everything. Not just what Sichon had, but what Moab had as well. Now, why couldn't we just wage battle against Moab? So this is based on a pasuk in Sefer Dvarim, where the pasuk says, "Vayomer Adonai Eli al tatsar es Moav al tisgar ba milchama." That we're not allowed to wage war against Moab. So how are we supposed to conquer the areas of Moab if we can't wage battle against them? How are we supposed to conquer the area that we have to conquer if we can't wage battle against them? Hashem says, "I have a great chap. First, I'm going to have Sichon beat Moab. A is going to beat B. And then you, the Jewish people, who are going to be C, are going to come and beat A. And if A beats B and C beats A, then C has everything." I think that works out. You'll have to tell me. That shows a lot about last time I took my SATs, right? But if Sichon beats Moab and we beat Sichon, then we get the whole kit and caboodle. We get the whole kitchen sink. We get everything. We couldn't wage battle against Moab directly. And so Hashem manufactures, Hashem orchestrates geopolitical events, which take a little bit of time to play out, only for the betterment of the Jewish people. So if you had frozen the scene at the end of Pasuk 26, you would have assumed that Sichon was on the ascent, Sichon was on the rise, and if you were a Jew reading that, you'd say, oh boy, here it goes, Sichon's powerful, Sichon's coming to get us, we stand no shot. We, of course, know that the story as it plays out is Hashem was just setting the table for us to be able to come along to defeat Sichon and therefore to have everything that belonged to both Sichon and to Moab. That is the Cheshbon. You see, Rashi over there on the Pasuk says, differently than the Gemara in Baba Basra, Rashi says, what's Al-Kain? Rashi says, Al-Kain, Al-Osa Milchama Shenilchon Sichon B'Moab. Because of the fight between Sichon and Moab, therefore you should make a Cheshbon. Therefore you should introspect. Again, what's the connection? The connection is that this entire narrative of Sichon beating Moab, of therefore us being Sichon, is really a reflection about how Hashem runs the world. That there are times where we see a little sliver of the puzzle. We see a little piece of the pie. And we don't understand how that fits into the greater narrative of how Hashem is unfolding the trajectory of world history. And so we might say one country on the up, on the ascent, one country that's conquering, and we might say to ourselves, oh boy, this is not going to be good for the Jews. Or what gives them the bracha to be worthy of so much blessing, being able to conquer so much land? What we don't realize is that oftentimes Hashem is just setting the stage. He's laying the dominoes up for the betterment of the Jewish people. Rav Nevensaul gives the following example. He says, if you were to ask 200 years ago what England did to merit such a large portion of the world, British colonies, Asia, Africa, America, Australia, what did England do to be worthy of so much of the world? See, you wouldn't have had a clear answer. England? I don't know. What did England do, right? The queen, her wave? I don't know. What makes her worthy of conquering large swaths of the... And then you come to the beginning of the 20th century. And then you come to 1918, World War I, post-World War I, and the Balfour Declaration. And you say to yourself, all of a sudden, because England is such a powerful monarchy, now they're able to take over from the Turks at the end of the World War I, the Ottoman Empire. They're able to control Palestine. They're going to set the stage for the Jewish people to return to Israel. And even though the white papers, it's going to be a little bit bumpy along the way, ultimately that's what puts into motion, really, the founding of the State of Israel. So if 200 years ago you had told me, what did England do to merit all this? I would say, I don't know. It's random. Happens to be chance. Now I'll tell you, no. Don't you see that Hashem was simply setting the stage for the Balfour Declaration for 1948? Right? World War II, America's entrance into World War II, Pearl Harbor. Right? So much of that was setting the stage for the founding of the State of Israel, that America was now a world military power. They were more respected than they were 10 years ago or during the Great Depression. Their economy was so much larger. Now, when they say there's a State of Israel, people take it seriously. And so we sometimes look at the world through a very narrow lens, through a very small piece of the puzzle. Well, we have to realize, bov nasu cheshbon, we have to do a cheshbon. We have to be willing to look at the big picture, not just the here and now, but the big picture, and say, sometimes it just takes Hashem a little bit of time to play out the events of world history. That's why I think the Gemara in Baba Basra, and I know I'm spending a little bit more time than I normally do on this idea, I just think it's such an important idea. The Gemara in Baba Basra says that what are we supposed to contemplate? The reward of a mitzvah versus the punishment. I'm sorry, the loss of a mitzvah versus the reward. Or the reward of an avera versus the punishment. It's the same thing. In other words, don't just look at the here and now. I turn on lights on Shabbos. Lightning doesn't strike me. Must be that nothing's going to happen. Hashem has a much longer view of history than you and I do. If Hashem doesn't answer our tefillos right now, it doesn't mean Hashem didn't hear our tefillos. It just means that it might take a month, a year, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years to play out the process of answering that tefillah. Right? We have a very finite, a very limited, narrow focus. Hashem sees all of eternity. We have to be patient with Hashem. Bo, Naso, Cheshbon. Sichon defeated Moab. If you had stopped and frozen history then, you would have the big headline, Sichon conquering the Middle East. Lo and behold, a short while later, the Jewish people come, conquer Sichon, and you see, Hashem was just setting the stage for it all. Hashem was taking care of us the entire time. We didn't appreciate it at the time, but Hashem was taking care of us the entire time. We need to have a broader vision of history, a little bit more patience with Hashem as he allows it to play out. I think that is a gem, mamish, a gem of a Dvar Torah. I saw it from Nevensaul. I got very excited to share it with you. Okay, now I'll have to do a little shorter if I want to keep to my yekish minug of 3 ideas in 30 minutes. Okay, idea number 2 comes from a very different source from Nevensaul. comes from the Ishbitzer, Chassidus. The Ishbitzer points out, again, you can't talk about Parshas Chukas without talking about the sin of Meimeriva, the sin of hitting the rock. Of course, we know Moshe is instructed to talk to the rock. Instead, he hits the rock. Hashem says, you're not going to the land of Israel. You didn't sanctify my name. And of course, the rest, as they say, is history. Now, there has been Svarim. You could fill libraries of books about what exactly was Moshe Rabbeinu's sin. Was a sin that he got angry? We all know what Moshe's sin was. We've all had discussions about it. I want to add a little bit to it because I thought this was a beautiful interpretation from the Ishbitzer. Says the Ishbitzer, that really, how big was this rock? So the Ishbitzer says this rock was very small. And when it says, V'nasan Meimav, I believe that's the Pasuk, right? Right, V'nasan Meimav, from its waters, says the Ishbitzer, means that each rock had a unique amount of water to it. So a little rock gives a little water. A big rock gives a lot of water. This rock, says the Ishbitzer, was not a very big rock. And therefore is not supposed to give a lot of water. That's what Hashem wanted Moshe to go and to speak to this rock to produce a very finite, limited amount of water. Now, why in the world would Hashem want Moshe to only give a little bit of water? After all, the Jewish people were thirsty. They were going to be thirsty for the coming days as well. So the Ishbitzer says that Hashem wanted Moshe to give just a little bit of water so that the Jewish people would have to come back the next day and ask for water again. You see, if Hashem gave the Jewish people enough water for the whole year, so what would they do? They would daven for it that day. They would say, Hashem, we're so thirsty, we need water. Hashem would say, great, I'm giving you water for the entire year. When's the next time the Jewish people would daven for water? When's the next time water would be the conduit of a conversation between them and Hashem? It would be another year. Because they would know it's there the entire time. They would take it for granted. They would take the bracha for granted. And they would cease to rely on Hashem. They would cease to turn to Hashem in tefillah, begging him and asking him for a bounty of water. What Hashem had intended, similar to the mun, says the Ishbitzer, is for a limited amount of water each day. And so therefore the Jewish people would be obligated every single day to come before Hashem again and to ask from him and to request more water. Why? Why does Hashem want that request? The answer is because request is a relationship. Right? If you don't make requests of Hashem, you're going to forget Hashem. So the Jewish people want, I'm saying Hashem wants the Jewish people to remember him. And the easiest way, right, imagine a parent. So if you give your kids an unlimited credit card, they ain't never calling you again. They're going out and they're spending that credit card. If you have your kids ask you for money every time they go out, now, hey, Dad, I need a little bit of cash. Where are you going? Who are you going with? How late are you staying out? Right, it allows me to have that relationship. So Hashem's original intention was for Moshe to give just a little bit of water. And therefore, every day the Jewish people were going to have to come. And they were going to have to ask for it again. They were going to have to dive into Hashem again. Says the Ishbitzer, Kamo b'man, shahayu kol yom tzrichim lisa inem l'shamayim, v'chein b'mayim. Like the man, where every day they had to look up to the heavens. So too with the water. V'hu noach, asa v'hacha sharsa tekef habracha, v'lachein yatsu mayim rabim. The sin was that too much water came out. That was the sin of Moshe Rabbeinu, was that he brought out more water than was supposed to brought out. Vishasu me'atzmam. And they were able to just drink in bounty and plentifulness. V'al kein nen shu yan lo haminu bi lakti shenu v'lo hutzruchu b'chol yom lebracha. Moshe robbed the Jewish people of the opportunity to come before Hashem every day and to ask for the bracha. So Hashem's intention was every day, I'm going to give it to you fresh. And therefore, you're going to have to look at me. You're going to have to dive into me. You're going to have that relationship. Moshe's mistake was that he brought out too much water. And therefore, the Jewish people were no longer as reliant on Hashem. The Jewish people no longer looked to Hashem as regularly. They no longer dive into Hashem. And therefore, the relationship wasn't as strong. I think this is not just a beautiful understanding of Moshe's sin. It's not about hitting the rock. It's about that he brought out too much water. But I think much more importantly, it's an important lesson for every single one of us. You see, we sometimes get trapped into the mindset of saying, you know what, I have my job, I have my parnasa, I'm good. Right? Every now and then, there might be a bump in the road. Right? I have a new boss, I don't know what's going to be with my bonus. I'll look to Hashem, I'll daven for parnasa. But lo and behold, I'm a salaried employee, or you know, I have a lot in reserves. I'm okay. what we have to remember is that every single day we have to dive into Hashem for parnasa. Hashem doesn't want us to just assume and to take it for granted. Hashem wants it to be that relationship. He wants us to look towards Him in tefillah, into davening to Him. This is the Ishbitzer. I was just quoting from his Sefer Kometz HaMincha, and it's Os Pei Beis 82. That's the source for this Dvar Torah. Right, Hashem wants us to look to Him. So when I, right, think about it this way, I'll give you the best example, the Nile River. Right, the Nile River, the reason why it's so problematic is because they didn't have to rely on Hashem. When you have an abundance of water, you didn't have to rely on Hashem. The water was always there. You had irrigation systems, you had sustenance, right? The Nile was taking you away from Hashem. What's in the land of Israel? The land of Israel is the only land that is not described by bodies of water. Right? There are no rivers in Israel. It's surrounded, but there are no rivers in Israel. Where does water come from? Water comes from rain. Tamid Einei Hashem Elokecha Ba. The reason why in Israel there's no Nile River is because the sustenance should never come easily. Rather, what should we do like the man? We should be forced to look up to the heavens. Rain comes from the heavens. Right? Water, the rivers come from the ground. Rain comes from the heavens and forces us to look up and to recognize our reliance on Hashem. Says the Ishbitzer, that was the sin of Moshe. The sin of Moshe was that he deprived the Jewish people of the opportunity to recognize their reliance on Hashem. That is what each of us have to do when it comes to our parnasa, when it comes to food, to never forget what its source is, to never get so comfortable and to assume that just because I had parnasa yesterday, I have it today, but every single day, kichadash, we have to look to Hashem and daven to Him. So idea number one came from Rav Nevensol, the beautiful idea of recognizing the totality of history, to allow Hashem's master plan to play out, not to lose focus and not to get so focused on the narrow sliver that you and I are looking at. It requires emuna and it requires patience. Idea number two is from the Ishbitzer. Sin of Moshe Rabbeinu was that he brought out too much water. Hashem wanted only a little bit so that they'd have to come back and daven tomorrow. Moshe gave too much. And that was depriving the Jewish people of the recognition of where their sustenance came from. Important lesson for all of us when we recognize our parnasa, we recognize the brachos in our lives, just because they're here all the time, we should never forget where it comes from. Sun rose this morning, don't take that for granted. Your body's working this morning, don't take that for granted. Your heart's beating right now, don't take that for granted. You have children, grandchildren, nieces, nephews, family, don't take that for granted. Okay. Idea number three comes from Yehuda Shaviv in his Sefer Misinai Ba, where he points out, and again, we've spoken about this in the past. This happens to be my favorite parsha. Anyone know why? Extra credit if you put in the chat why it's my favorite parsha. It can't be my mom, though, and it can't be my wife. Extra credit if you have to guess why it's my favorite parsha. Okay, so in the parsha, we assume that there's only one song in the Torah, Shirat Hayam, that song sung when the Jewish people leave, when they leave Mitzrayim and they come to the Yamsuf. There is, in fact, another shir in the Torah, and it appears in this week's Parsha. In this week's Parsha, the Jewish people say, Az Yashir Yisrael Es Hashira Hazos. The Jewish people are singing a song. What's the song about? The song is about none other than the Be'er, the well that has been following them the entire time. Az Yashir Yisrael Es Hashira Hazos. Ali Ve'er Enu La. Oh, well, we sing to it, Be'er Chafarua Sarim Karua Nidve'am, right? And we sing for a few psukim about this Be'er. Rav Yehuda Shaviv points out, no one's gotten it yet. Why is it my favorite parsha? Come on, right? And Rav Yehuda Shaviv points out, the Grunsteins, extra credit. The Grunsteins, yes, it was my bar mitzvah parsha. Excellent. It's my birthday next week. So Rav Yehuda Shaviv points out that there are many differences between this song in the song of the Yom Suf. First of all, obviously one's much more prominent than the other, right? The Yom Suf we say every morning. We learn in school, we sing about it, we know the trup to it. This song is buried there. Most people don't even know about it. We glance over it very quickly. Another noticeable difference is that, what? Is that Moshe, right? The first song in the Yom Suf is Az Yashir Moshe of Israel. Moshe leads the song. Here it's Az Yashir Israel. Moshe is absent. Why is Moshe absent? So again, a number of different interpretations. Either you have the Medrash, who says that the reason why Moshe is absent here is because right after Moshe was punished with water, he's now going to sing to water. Right? Moshe was punished at Meh Meriva. All of a sudden, he's going to sing about how great water is? Doesn't really fit. Other interpretations is that Moshe just finished sitting Shiva for his sister Miriam. Miriam died. The Be'er, the well, dries up because she died. It's a little strange, right after Shiva, to sing a song about something you lose because your sister died. So there are a number of interpretations of why Moshe is absent. I like the interpretation, which is that in Parshas Beshalach, the Jewish people needed Moshe. They were an infant nation. They were an unsophisticated nation, so they needed Moshe to teach them how to sing. Here in this week's Parsha, they're already mature. They've been down this road before, and so they know how to lead song on themselves. It's a sign of maturity. It's a sign of development from Hashem and from the Jewish people. But what I want to point out is one last difference, and it's such an obvious difference. This is not a chiddush, but I think it's such an important difference. The song at the Yamsuf, what makes it so amazing is the pomp and circumstance that was surrounding it. Any Tom, Dick, or Harry who was at the Kriyas Yamsuf would have sung Shir HaSayam. Here you had the Egyptians barreling down at you. You're caught between a proverbial rock and hard place, right? I always say envision yourself being at the end of Palmetto Park Road with the, you know, German Nazis coming down one way with the Atlantic Ocean on the other way, and you're panicking, you're screaming out. All of a sudden, the Atlantic Ocean splits. You go through. They all drown. Anyone with half a brain would have been singing Yam Suf, would have been singing Shir HaSayam at that moment in time. Anyone. You didn't have to be a particularly sophisticated person to recognize the Yad Hashem. So that was such an open, overt miracle that everyone was doing it. The song in this week's Parsha is very different, because at this point, the Be'er, the well, has been with the Jewish people for 40 years. For 40 years, every single morning they woke up, they went to the well, they got their water. Afternoon, they got thirsty, they went to the well, they got their water. Before they went to sleep, they went to water, they went to the well. 40 years, day in, day out, the well was there right in front of their faces. That is what we call a hidden miracle. It's a miracle that happens every day, all day, and yet, because it happens all the time, it blends into the background. Says Rav Yehuda Shaviv, you want to know the chiddush of the song in this week's Parsha? Is that even those things which are so ubiquitous, even those things that formulate almost like the backdrop of our lives, we stop noticing them, even those we have to sing to Hashem for. It's not just enough to praise Hashem for the things that are earth-shattering, the one-time mega events, but we have to thank Hashem and we have to sing songs to Hashem, even for those things which are so obvious in our lives. The Be'er was there all the time. It was the classic example of a hidden miracle because it was there all the time. They got used to it. And yet all of a sudden they lost it. Miriam dies and they lose that miracle. And they wake up one morning, they go to get water and it's not there. They say to themselves, Oy Gewalt, we had this gift. We had this miracle there the entire time and we didn't even realize it. And now they sing the song because they realize that they didn't even appreciate the miracle while it was there. I don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand how profound this is for us in our lives. As we said a few moments ago, how many miracles, billions of miracles happen to us every single day. But because they happen every single day, we stop paying attention to them. I went to the bathroom, my heart's beating, the sun's shining, the birds are chirping, the grass is growing, I have a roof over my head and clothes on my body and money in my bank account. Gazillions of brachos every single day. But because they happen every day, we stop paying attention to them and we take them for granted. And so we stop thanking Hashem for them. When do we notice them? Tragically, we notice them the first time it stops working. You notice the roof on your house the moment there's a leak in that roof and you say, ah, it was working so well for so many years. You notice your body the first time something starts breaking down in your body and you say, I really took that for granted the whole time. And only when we lose something do we take it for granted. Says Rosh Aviv, the lesson here is not to wait until you lose it to appreciate it the entire time. To think, when we say modim 3 times a day, to really reflect about how grateful we should be to Hashem for the gazillions of brachos that are in our lives every single day. If you recall a few years ago, Rabbi Menachem Penner, the head of Reitz, when he was here, he said that before he says modim, he pauses and he listens to his heartbeat. And then he says modim. And I always thought that imagery was so powerful. Because if you think about it, the heartbeat is that classic example of something that we take for granted. And so by thinking about his heartbeat, he's really saying to Hashem, I'm not taking anything for granted. I'm thanking you for everything that you do for me. A beautiful insight by Rav Shaviv. So we saw three ideas, 30 minutes. I think these might be some of the best three ideas we've done yet, which means we're only getting stronger, right? The first idea was Rav Nevin saw, which I thought was amazing, right? Bo nasu cheshbon. What's the cheshbon? The cheshbon is not just to look at your little sliver of world history and to get frustrated with Hashem, but to recognize that just as Sichon defeated Moab, so that we can defeat Sichon and take everything, Moab and Sichon, but you got to let it play out. You have to let history play itself out a little bit. You have to be a little patient with Hashem, have emunah in him, that he knows what he's doing, and that while it might not happen in the way we want, in the time frame we want, you got to believe it's going to happen. Idea number two is from the Ishbitzer. What was Moshe's sin? Moshe's sin was that he provided too much water. Hashem wanted just a little bit, so that the Jewish people would continue to have to re-engage in their reliance on Hashem, to constantly dive into him. By giving too much water, they lost sight of that. They started thinking it was natural for them to have water all around. That, says the Ishbitzer, was the problem with Moshe. It's a lesson for us that, again, we should dive into Hashem, that we should always ask Hashem, even for things that we think we have in the bank account, we should always recognize our reliance in Hashem. Idea number three is the contrast between the song of the Be'er in this week's Parsha, the well in this week's Parsha, the song of the Yamsuf. The song of the Yamsuf is easy. Anyone could do it. The song of the well in our Parsha, the whole Chiddush of it was, is that it was so obvious that they stopped even being grateful for it. It was always there. And it's only when they lost it, did they then start to appreciate what they had the entire time. We should not wait until we lose certain things to appreciate that they are gifts from Hashem. Every single day, we should wake up with that attitude of gratitude. We should feel grateful for Hashem, appreciate Hashem, and thank Him, Hashem, for the gazillions and gazillions of miracles that He performs in our lives on a daily basis. And with that, I wish everyone a beautiful, meaningful, and inspirational Shabbos.